Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry.
On this episode of the Alpha Exchange, Dean had the pleasure of catching up with Aaron Brown, a portfolio manager at PIMCO. Through their discussion, we learn of Aaron's introduction to the study of macro, a discipline she instantly found fascinating and has underpinned her more than two-decade career in markets. At More Capital, through the buildup and ultimate unwind of the U.S. housing bubble, Aaron provides perspective she gathered during the GFC, laying out the time spent on idea generation, as well as efforts to optimize the trade construction. Because these shorts became so large, having a game plan on profit-taking also became an important consideration. The conversation also focuses on the 2020 pandemic and how Aaron and her team successfully positioned portfolios at PIMCO through that volatility episode. Surveying the set of risks that comprise today's investing landscape, Aaron is focused on inflation and, importantly, the Fed's reaction function to the data. She sees vulnerability in SpecTech, that equity market segment with lofty valuations and for which higher interest rates appear a real headwind. But there is value out there, and in EM, Aaron sees cheap assets on both the FX and equity side. Dean closes the conversation by soliciting Aaron's views on the opportunity set for women in finance. Recently named to the highly prestigious list of the Barron's 100 Most Influential Women in Finance, Aaron is in a great position to share her views. She sees lots of progress, with excellent efforts to support women at the junior level and more still to do with the mid-level segment of female career development. Please enjoy Dean's discussion with Aaron Brown.
My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Aaron Brown. She is the Managing Director and Head of Asset Allocation for PIMCO. Aaron, thanks for joining us today on the Alpha Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's get started at the beginning. Tell us how you initially established yourself in the area of finance. What is it that initially sparked the interest? And tell us about your first foray on Wall Street.
Sure. So when I entered Georgetown University as an undergraduate student, I started off pre-med with really no knowledge or intention of going into finance. But I took a couple of economics classes and particularly some macroeconomic classes while at Georgetown and really fell in love with the subject and wanted to explore that more. During my junior summer at Georgetown, I accepted an internship at Lehman Brothers, where I really fell in love with the dynamicism of the trade floor and the new subject matter that I was learning every single day, and realized that that was something that I wanted to pursue full time. So I went back to Lehman after graduating and spent 3 years in their investment banking program, where I really had a formative sort of training in security analysis and how to look at markets. From there, I moved over to Neuberger Berman, which at the time was Lehman's wholly owned subsidiary on the mutual fund side, to start my career on the buy side in equity research, and spent a year there before moving over to More Capital, which was really my start in exploring macro and how macro fundamentals and economics really influence markets. It really was one of the best learning experiences, in some ways drinking from a fire hose, but very much one of the best learning experiences that I could have had for learning about how to approach macro for markets.
So the time at More Capital, tell us what years that spanned.
I started in 2004 and left in 2009 at the beginning of the housing crisis. And I remember very early days, I had a very strong model analytical background based on my time both at Lehman as well as Neuberger Berman. And I kind of liked building models. That was something that I was good at. And while I had no experience with credit, and specifically with structured credit, they asked me to build and look at the ABS market and the CMBX market, get a little bit of a, understanding with what was going on there and see whether or not there was anything to do in terms of trading positions at More. So I built and worked with the sell side and as well as worked with some of our own internal resources to build out ABX and CMBX models for More Capital. And it ended up turning into a really great trade for us. We were early in taking short positions and pretty large size in the ABS and CMBX market at the sort of inception of the housing crisis. We traded it really quite well. And then while that market was starting to trade off, we started to look at some of the banks and the bank equities that were exposed to CMBX market, commercial and residential mortgages. And we started to build short positions in those banking securities and did quite well on a regional bank short as well. So it was pretty early in my days at Moore, but it was a really great opportunity for me to dig in very early on and add value and see the results of that work expressed in the fund.
This is so interesting to span from 2004 to 2009. You've got this pre-crisis period where the VIX is low and going lower, and credit default swaps in and around 2006 had reached the lowest we'd ever seen them, especially on banks and almost paradoxically on banks. And then, of course, this tidal wave of systemic risk emerges. What was that like? Take us inside the development of your own thought process in watching a market go from ultra stability, right? There was all the talk of the great moderation. The central banks were the heroes that had conquered the business cycle. And then it all ended pretty badly in terms of the shock that emerged. Walk us through just the evolution of your thought process over that fascinating five-year period.
You know, I think what we did well and what Moore continues to do well and why it's been so successful and stood the test of time was the ability to spot long-term trends and deviations from those trends and how economic fundamentals were starting to change and starting to shift. And so we were oftentimes early, but oftentimes right at the same time. And having, you know, the ability to withstand that conviction, despite the fact that the markets weren't yet responding to some of the fundamental changes that we were seeing being undertaken in the market, I think, you know, helped me at least in terms of being instructive for how I think about risk taking today, which is, you know, starting off really digging in and looking at the fundamentals, at the macro fundamentals, looking for those macro fundamental inflections, and then starting to build small risk positions as the macro continues to unfold. And ultimately, as the markets start to wake up to the fact that the macro fundamentals are changing. And so I think for me, being early in my career and sort of learning that process and being able to have conviction in that process was fairly formative in terms of how I think about risk taking today.
To be right on a trade almost necessarily means you have to be at least a little bit early. But sometimes yeah. Being too early can be really tough. Carrying positions, you saw this in, you know, in The Big Short, and you guys probably experienced some of this as well. Those credit protection positions weren't cheap, especially as you sort of migrated down the credit curve away from IG and into things that were more exposed to mortgages. Folks had to lug the premium for a bit. What's the lesson there in terms of maybe trade construction or staying convicted in a trade, but also recognizing that the market may not be moving on the same time schedule that you are? How do you kind of position yourself to be early and to withstand the time it takes sometimes for the trade to materialize?
I think you're absolutely right, which is you're oftentimes early. And I think that being able to take small positions on to begin with and build into those positions as you start to see more momentum in your favor in that trade is really key to portfolio construction and ultimately being able to withstand being early and potentially being wrong for a period before you're really right. So, you know, sometimes it's important to just have small positions on in the book so that you're invested in the idea, you're watching it, you're really keyed into how fundamentals are evolving, but you don't want to be too big too early. And you also want to be really diversified in the risk bins that you have on in your portfolio. And so even today, and you know, probably even more so today, I think diversification across strategies, across products, across different frames or positions that you have in your portfolio are really key to careful and appropriate portfolio risk construction.
How much
much of it is getting the macro idea right, which is, in this case, some gigantic imbalance in the housing sector and the securities built around it. So getting that right, but then also the trade expression itself. How much time did you guys spend really, really digging into the myriad ways of actually expressing that trade? How would you differentiate the original idea and then actually the implementation as a source of value as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think as I think about it today, I would say that maybe 60 to 70% of my time is spent on the idea generation, and probably call it 35% on average of the time is really spent on the way to express that trade most efficiently, as well as with the most potential to generate alpha. So we do spend a significant amount of time on trade construction, has been critical and key to a successful outcome for those trades. It's very easy to get the idea or the theme right, but trade it wrong. I learned that, and I think that was probably my biggest lesson that I learned while at SAC and Point 72, which was learning from Steve how to trade, because I think a lot of people are really good idea generators, but aren't really good traders. And I think my time spent at SAC really taught me how to be a good trader as opposed to just a good idea generator.
Well, let's spend some time on that post-crisis period of your career as well. Post-crisis, but before a pandemic, let's call it. But last question just on the global financial crisis is success. The success of the trades mean, especially in a vol shock like we experienced in 07, 08, early 09, means that those trades just become gigantic. You're now carrying trades at massive levels of risk premium on the successful side. But at some point, and you know, we'll talk about, again, this in the context of last year as well, the Fed and the government absolutely are kind of fighting you, right? You're essentially short something that they want to stabilize and for it to go back up. And so back to, you know, that crazy period in, let's call it early 09, how does a firm, you know, like More Capital pivot on a winning position that becomes vulnerable because the firepower of the Fed and the government are designed to try to overwhelm the market at that point?
When looking and discussing portfolio efficiency, you have to also understand when something is well priced. So when it gets to about 75% to 80% close to your target, that's when you should start taking off some of the risk in that position and starting to lighten the position, because you're never going to time something perfectly. So as you start to approach it, you should be cutting your risk in that position. The second is then looking for potentially lateral trades that haven't priced the same outcome, that maybe aren't fully priced. That's, I think, key to, you know, a successful outcome in portfolios. I think, you know, secondarily to that, one of the biggest inputs that I have now and has certainly had at More as well is policy and implications for tail risks and policy for portfolios. And so I think stress testing different positions, not just on a portfolio level, but on a position level to different potential policy outcomes is also critical and key to successful outcomes in portfolios.
There's no two events, I think, that describe the potential for markets to experience massive volatility than the global financial crisis and then the pandemic last year at this time in March. But the in-between periods can be interesting as well. And of course, that was a big part of your career development. I was hoping you could share with us a little bit about some of the skills and how you hone your craft at Point 72. What were the maybe key events or some of the market environments in which you traded through? And then specifically with respect to Point 72, you know, you mentioned the trading aspect of it. What are some of the learning experiences that you took away from that part of your career?
I think that what Point 72 does arguably better than any other firm is trade and be really efficient and very focused on efficient portfolio construction, risk construction, as well as trading. And so when I joined SAC, it really was because I felt like I was a great strategist. I was great at coming up with ideas. But what I lacked and wanted to learn was how to trade. And I felt like working there would give me the best on the ground training for being able to observe what Steve does so well and what he's really built his career on. And I remember when I first started, very early on, you know, I walked up to Steve and I gave him an idea to be short utilities versus, you know, long the S&P and long the market, basically, and had really constructed sort of this elegant, what I thought was elegant rationale for being short utilities. And he liked the idea and he put it on and he sized it up and scaled it. And I put it on at the same time. And I remember he made about 5 times more money than I did on the similarly sized position of the same exact trade. It was my idea. We entered it just about the same time. And yet his ability to trade it was so much better than mine that he just like left me in the dust. We both made money. He just made a lot more money than I did. And so that was pretty formative and pretty instrumental in terms of setting me on a path to really digging in and exploring, you know, how to trade, how to make money trading, and really watching and observing what he did so well in order to really hone my craft within trading.
It's so interesting to hear it. Of course, we all know the stories from the outside looking in terms of trading acumen, but to hear it so directly like that is really interesting. So 0.72, more cap, you know, hedge fund focused businesses, of course. And then, as you said, you moved into UBS Asset Management. You were the head of asset allocation there. Tell us a little bit about that transition in terms of from a pure hedge fund environment to something more of an asset management environment. What are the differences? What are some of the similarities as well?
I think the reason why UBS hired me into asset management and into a more traditional asset management role was really to apply some of the models and the systematic sort of process orientation that I'd built throughout my career working at different macro hedge funds and apply those same principles and sort of philosophies to managing asset allocation accounts. And it's really not that different in the sense that really what you're doing when you're building asset allocation portfolios is quite similar to building macro portfolios, except you're doing it relative to a benchmark. But, you know, I think a lot of the same principles, a lot of the same risk parameters apply, albeit on a different scaling and different tracking error as opposed to absolute basis or absolute terms. And so what I think I brought to UBS was a real process in terms of how to think about macro and apply it across asset allocation portfolios to construct more efficient and more sort of systematic or process-oriented portfolios. What I've continued to sort of develop and evolve that process, but the way that I think about developing asset allocation portfolios is across both a structural component, which sort of underpins the long-term risk premium expectations for portfolios, and layer on top of that a tactical asset allocation model-based approach to thinking about how different macro drivers should alter or influence different risk asset classes over a more cyclical horizon. So, you know, embedded a view on risk sentiment, on monetary policy. And so using macro models to forward predict what our expectations are across those 4 different vectors can give us a pretty good understanding of the direction on a tactical basis for macro markets. On top of that, we layer systematic strategies, which are long-term risk premium harvesting strategies that take advantage of dislocations in the market. And then on top of that, layer in a discretionary RV, what you could think of as a traditional macro RV strategies, security selections and asset class selections. And what I think differentiated about that approach is that not only are we using both model-based approach formulate some of those opinions, but we're also layering on top of it discretionary RV approach to looking at market. In developing the strategy, pull from different risk periods and time periods for the different strategies that we deploy. So on the structural basis, we're looking at long-term sort of risk premium normalization. On the tactical basis, we're looking at more 3 to 6 month deviations in markets. And in the RV, we're looking for trades that, you know, we think are going to unfold over the next 1 to 3 months. And so I think that by having variety and dispersion on the timeframes that you're looking at, as well as the systematic versus discretionary models that you're looking at. It gives you a lot of diversification in the approach that you take for managing portfolios.
You mentioned monetary policy as one of the inputs. And of course, any great crisis event invites and requires a great response. I just came across a quote from George Bush in September of 2008. He said, "It's a big package because it's a big problem," right? You can't sit by and watch the markets deteriorate too much, because they can really undermine themselves. And so post the GFC, we had this pretty significant heavy hand of the Fed for years. It took them a long time to get off zero. You know, a lot of, I guess you'd call it, financial repression through that period. And we would not have known just how much more they would do, even versus the GFC in March of 2020. But in between these two great crisis events, we did have a pretty significant presence of the central banks. And I'm just curious if you can walk us through the evolution of your risk management process as the central banks became a little omnipresent in markets. How did that impact the types of relationships that you looked at on an absolute and relative basis, and, you know, just on an overall basis, your risk-taking process?
So it certainly has influenced certainly fundamentals and fundamental values or intrinsic values for asset classes, and therefore for the way that we think about managing risk around those different asset classes. And, you know, to be honest, that continues to evolve. I don't think that anyone had expected 10 years ago that we would still be at ultra low rates today. I actually remember I took part of a survey that was done just at the beginning of the financial crisis, you know, a little bit over 10 years ago, where different market participants were polled what their expectations were for rates in the next 5 years. And so this was, you know, probably back in 2008. The large majority of people, I think pretty much everyone, had rates above 5%. You know, clearly, we know where rates ended up over the last 10 years, and they've never touched anywhere close to 5%. And so, you know, I do think that viewpoints have changed dramatically. We may never get back to, you know, a more normalized rate environment, how much involvement they've taken to date, and how, you know, disruptive it would be, given potential growth, for them to really actively disengage from markets over the near term, at least. I think that many of the firms that I've worked at have had really close relationships with former central bankers and with people who have spent a lot of time watching the Fed and looking at the Fed and engaging and dialoguing with the Fed and other global central banks. I think that that has been quite helpful. But I also think that not being tethered to traditional, and mostly not sort of box ourselves into beliefs of what the Fed can do or would do, and being a little bit open-minded to, you know, a number of policy shifts that prior to the announcements we never thought possible. And so I think we're in an environment where we shouldn't be wedded to tradition, because we've seen willingness from global policymakers to make pretty significant.
Let's talk about the here and now, and I'd love to get your take on just so much of the, I would say, fascinating cross currents that characterize today's markets. And as I said, you have a big crisis, a pandemic. Markets really took it on the chin there, explosion of volatility. And then you get a gigantic response from both the Fed and the fiscal side as well. Maybe walk us through just 2020 from your perspective. I'd love to hear what your take was on things. If you can go back a year and think about that period in March, and just again, the explosion of volatility, and how do you manage risk through a period in which the S&P, you had a couple of days there where it moved 10% on a close-to-close basis. Mm-hmm. What was that period like for you?
We were fortunate in that we had entered the beginning of 2020 fairly defensively positioned, and that really resulted in the fact that we thought we were late cycle, that valuations were rich, and while there was certainly room for some potential upside, that as we were moving throughout 2020, we were going to get to a very late cycle environment and didn't want to be too overweight or positioned within risk products as a result of that. So we had built up liquidity in the portfolio, And you know, while we were expressing some equity, you know, risk in our portfolio, we were fairly defensive in terms of the sectors and the exposures that we had on. So during the downturn in March and April, we quickly shifted our book to be very up in quality and very, very liquid. We got rid of any residual trades that we had on that were not core to our central thesis. We also really delayered our portfolio. And I think that's one of the most critical things during risk-off periods where you see correlation spike. Having layered positions or layered risk in your portfolio can destroy you. So we quickly delayered a position. So we were really clean and very liquid assets and had raised cash as well. And so as we saw the market sell off and became just really silly in terms of the prices at which assets were trading, we actually started to build risk pretty, you know, aggressively at sort of the depths of the end of March and into early April, and were able to take advantage pretty well in terms of the rally off the lows in early April and into May. And I think that was really the result of the fact that we were defensive, we were delayered in terms of our risk, and we were really liquid and had that liquidity on the sideline in order to be able to add back risk quickly. So I think that we ended up navigating last year quite well and ended up doing well as a result of that. But it was really because of the starting position that we went in to start the year.
Step back and you look at today, the set of risks that keep you up at night these days in 2021, how would you frame that? Is it monetary policy? Is it valuations? Is it some of the pretty new risks that we see and things like a GameStop, you know, almost imposing risk upon the market? What do things look like from your perspective these days?
I think we're in a much healthier position in terms of where we are in the cycle, which is early cycle today, as well as in terms of where we are with respect to valuations. Albeit valuations are rich on a relative basis, I think they look more attractive today than they did at the end of 2019. That said, there's a pretty powerful argument that I think is unfolding in the market today with respect to inflation and how monetary policy is going to respond to inflation. And while I tend to be quite sanguine about inflation risks overall over the next 1 to 2 years for the economy, specifically the U.S. economy, it doesn't mean the market isn't going to test the Fed and test their, you know, sort of the credibility of the average inflation targeting framework that they've unveiled at the end of last year. And so I think that that interplay between potentially rising short-term inflation, at least through the mid part of this year, and the Fed's conviction to be able to look through that short-term inflation is going to be, I think, the biggest, you know, sort of argument or the biggest event risk. I do think that is credible. There's not going to be volatility in the days and months and sort of 6 months ahead during that time frame.
You step back and you look at maybe the 60 basis points we've seen from the 10-year from, let's call it, a percent to 1.6%, and you maybe just decompose the causality of those 60 basis points. Some people point to supply, some people point to reflation, some people call it inflation. How would you characterize that backup in rates?
Well, we just came from a period of the worst economic recession in the U.S. in over 70 years, and with inflation that, you know, sort of fell and collapsed beyond, you know, what economists certainly had forecasted. And we're now coming out of that to an environment where we're expecting GDP growth to be, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8%, depending on which economists that you read or speak to, which will be the best cyclical growth backdrop for the U.S. and again, in over 70 years. And so I think that that quick reversal from a very late cycle environment to a very early cycle environment has created a very rapid normalization in rates set against the fact that we're doing enormous amounts of fiscal stimulus. And so it's hard to have rates, nominal rates at 1.5, 1.6% and real rates at negative 110 basis points when you're expecting to see GDP growth about 7%. I mean, that's just unrealistic. And so to me, this is a normalization of rates. It started with a move higher in break-even inflation expectations at the, you know, sort of end of last year and the start of this year, which I think was a normalization of inflation. And now we're seeing a little more of a normalization in rates, which has been sort of the second half of this backup in yields that we've seen. But to me, we're still in an environment that's quite supportive for risk. Albeit it's been very rapid, particularly the backup that we saw in real rates in the month of February and into early March, that's certainly been very rapid. But, you know, think about the starting point to where we are today. We're still in an environment where real rates are still quite negative. And to me, the absolute levels are quite supportive for risk, albeit, you know, there's been some agita and volatility along the way.
There's a lot of ways to look at inflation. There's you can look at charts on commodity prices, and there's been many of those that have certainly experienced a significant and rapid increase. But from the Fed's perspective, and I know it's got a massive dashboard of metrics it's looking at, but core PCE is its stated objective function in terms of, you know, where it's trying to guide the inflation level. And that's notoriously range bound. Just looking back, it's maybe over the last 10 years, it's really spent 80% of its time between 1.4 and 1.8%. It's a pretty non-volatile number. I'm curious if in a lot of what the market seems to be discussing is just the Fed's reaction to the data. And so I'm wondering if you can share with us how you would look at, or how you would think the Fed would react in a way that caused it to move more quickly than the market wanted it to, right? So that the fears that the market may be grappling with right now become fulfilled because the Fed's body language actually does change. What might that look like in terms of the data that would unfold? How would the Fed, what data would cause the Fed to potentially have to shift its body language?
I think that the Fed is in a little bit of a tough spot to react quickly to changes in core PCE over the next, you know, several months and really throughout this year and into 2022. And the reason for that is that, you know, they spent a considerable amount of time undertaking a pretty deep dive in Fed listening sessions with respect to the crisis, as well as with respect to, and when I say crisis, I don't mean the pandemic, but I mean the post-crisis period after the global financial crisis, and in terms of why inflation has been so sticky and why wage growth has been so subdued. And, you know, from that and from their analysis came up with this new average inflation targeting, which really looks to take a more symmetrical approach to averaging to a 2% inflation target over, you know, a more secular horizon, as opposed to a 2% inflation ceiling, which they've averaged to in the past. And as a result of that, in order to build credibility in that new framework, which they just announced, I think that they're not going to be as reactive, certainly as the market expects, but even as reactive as they have been in the past during the taper tantrum of 2016. Instead, I think that they are going to be more gradual. They've also talked about wanting a more inclusive economy and a more inclusive unemployment rate. And what that means is not just averaging to the U6, but looking, you know, to broader unemployment measures in order to, you know, appropriately evaluate what lower wage earners and how they're faring in terms of wage growth as well as unemployment rates in the economy. And in, so in order to do that, they really have to run the inflation hot, and they have to be able to run that hot for a sustained period of time. So what I would be looking for is not just their expectations for PCE inflation at 2%, but that we're actually realizing core PCE inflation above 2%, so, you know, close to 2.4, 2.5% for a sustained period of months, and that their forward expectations for inflation sustained at that level going forward. They're going to be using a one-year look back if for consideration for that core PCE measure. So it really is going to take time for that to unfold. And so the market, you know, forward pricing and expecting that we're going to have liftoff in, you know, 2022 or even early 2023, that doesn't give the Fed enough time for core PCE to fall in that 1 year look back window. So I think the market is early in terms of its anticipation of future rate hikes.
I think one of the things that folks are looking at in terms of the backup in rates is just the impact on the risk asset environment. And, you know, specifically tech stocks have proven to be pretty vulnerable to higher rates. Some people call tech stocks long duration assets. And so this backup in rates has been pretty unwelcome. And there's also a lot of discussion, and I saw an interview that you had done with Bloomberg a couple of weeks ago on the regime that we're in, or that we may be approaching in terms of stock bond correlation. There's a lot of folks that have suggested that that stock bond risk on, risk off, you know, the negative correlation in the prices is really now a thing of the past. You seem to have a little bit of a different take on that. I was hoping you could share with us how we should think about the role of bonds in a portfolio. Can we still expect it to be a stabilizer? What's your current thinking?
So I think there's two questions there to unpack. The first is with respect to sectors like tech, which are long duration assets. You know, I think you have to separate tech, spec tech versus sort of higher quality tech investments. But I would not be long duration equities right now, you know, particularly spec tech. I think that, you know, as duration continues to sell off, clearly those equities that are more exposed or more long duration are going to underperform. And, you know, certainly given the starting point for valuations for those assets, they, you know, have room for potential further downside, which can be pretty considerable for certain names. I think that there's better opportunities out there in equity markets, easier ways to make money within equities, and probably starting or focusing your time on early cyclical plays or even mid-cycle cyclical plays right now make a lot more sense than broad overweight risk to the technology sector, which has fallen out of favor. With respect to stock bond correlation, you know, over the short term, I expect to see that stock bond correlation will be neutral at best to maybe slightly positive as we go through this re-rating of duration expectations and inflation expectations. And so I think that duration will sell off slightly from here, and stock bond correlation, you know, can sustain a higher level than what we've seen over the last 10 years or so. But when you take a step back and you look at longer term stock bond correlation over, you know, a 1 year, 5 year, 10 year look back, opposed to a 1 day, 1 week, 1 month look back, I do think over the long time frame, stock bond correlation will sustain its sort of negative correlation. And then when you've seen real shifts in terms of inflation running hot and sustaining, and Fed credibility being called in to be able to not be able to cool off that hot inflation. And I think that the Fed has the tools, has the credibility, has the, not just the ability, but the will to stem an overheating economy that where inflation is, you know, sort of spiraling out of control. And so as long as we think inflation will remain tamed, which I do, stock bond correlation will remain negative over longer time frames. And so I do think that in that environment, bonds still have a role to play. On a tactical basis, I wouldn't be long or overweight duration right now as the market continues to go through this very episodic position adjustment. But I think it's just that. I think it's a short-term phenomenon. And I don't think this is going to persist over the next, you know, 1 to 2 years. I think it's a position squeeze and changing to a new regime, and then the market will settle down.
So one thing that is unique in 2020 and certainly into 2021 is fiscal policy. The United States and really the world has found this new lever and is pulling on it pretty aggressively as a way of pushing back against the pandemic job losses and the deflationary forces. Tell us about how that makes its way into your team's analysis and your process for portfolio construction.
The first way is really evaluating how we can take advantage of some of the fiscal package initiatives in our portfolio. So whether it's looking at infrastructure plays and sectors that will be beneficiaries of additional fiscal stimulus dollars, or whether it's looking at how the U.S. is responding to the pandemic and its fiscal response relative to other countries in helping to build or inform our dollar positioning and our duration positioning. Both have been, I think, instrumental in terms of how we positioned our portfolio this year across asset classes. So we have taken advantage of really doing a lot of deep dive and analysis and looking at the spending programs on the fiscal side and using that to help inform our decision making across asset classes this year. The second, I think, more philosophical question with regards to fiscal is ultimately the longer term impact that fiscal is going to have on duration. And at PIMCO, certainly, as well as on my team, we spent a lot of time thinking about the long-term implications of fiscal policy and whether or not it's going to be sustained and ultimately what that impact is for the fair value of duration securities.
You mentioned the dollar, so let's shift there. I'd love to get your take on the implications for the dollar, and then maybe by way of translation, I know you've spent some time managing emerging market portfolios during your career as well. So that's linked to the dollar. What's your outlook for the dollar?
So I think that the outlook for the dollar has been shifting pretty rapidly throughout this year. When we started the year, we had been quite short the dollar, particularly against developed market cyclical ex-US currencies relative to the US dollar. So funding in the dollar and long a basket of cyclically exposed developed market currencies. As we have moved through this year and as the US duration has sold off pretty aggressively, which made just the value of US assets more attractive relative to the rest of the world, you know, we've become a little bit more sanguine in terms of our relative FX positions and taken down risk across the board in our FX positions. I still think that there's a lot of value in emerging market currencies. With respect to the virus, has been a lot slower in their response. And they've been met with, you know, sort of volatility shocks in the markets along the way, which certainly is never a good environment for emerging markets. So while there is, I think, tremendous value for differentiation in emerging markets this year, and it is something that we have on in small size, being long EMFX, you know, funded against euro and the dollar, it's a position that's quite small right now, and I think needs more time to evolve and for the not only for the global economy to improve, but also for the emerging markets response to the pandemic to improve in order to really build up those positions more aggressively.
What are the implications for just the broad landscape of emerging market risk assets like equities? Are there opportunities there? Do things screen cheap on the equity side in emerging markets?
Absolutely, particularly on a relative basis versus developed market equities. I think from a secular, longer-term basis, the sort of emerging market equities are quite cheap, but they've been cheap for the last decade. So you never really want to invest purely in EM equities because they look cheap, because we've learned that they can stay cheap indefinitely. So the question really is what is that catalyst? We've been looking at companies that are levered to the cyclical recovery in global markets, particularly on the manufacturing or more of the hard commodity side that, you know, have done well of late and we think are going to be continue to do well. We've also looked at secular disruptors within emerging markets, whether it be in LATAM on the green revolution or in Asia on secular tech disruptors that we think will be advantaged over the next sort of 5 to 10 years, you know, because of some of these disruption themes. So I do think that stock selection and security selection within EM makes a lot of sense. And there's certain baskets or themes that we've constructed to take advantage of those longer term views that we have in markets that we think emerging market, because of the ability to take advantage of some of these differentiations and idiosyncratic name stories, makes a lot of sense.
It's been an excellent conversation, and I was hoping we could pull away from markets and end with some of your valuable perspectives on the development of careers for women in finance. You are among the Barron's 100 most influential women in finance, sitting there next to folks like Janet Yellen. So that's no small honor. Congratulations on that. That's incredible. And
thank
so
you.
You're in a great position as someone who's had a career across hedge funds and now at a giant asset manager, PIMCO. I'd love to get your perspective on just that project, you know, called Empowering Women in Careers in Finance. There's been some initiatives. You were kind enough to speak at the one I hosted back in 2018, but I'd love to just get your perspective on what you see and where the progress is and what needs to occur to increase the level of progress.
Yeah, you know, firstly, I want to start off by saying I think this is a great career path for women. I have a lot of flexibility. You know, certainly I've been in this career a long time and I didn't have flexibility in my career early on. But as I've grown and as I've matured and taken on, you know, bigger, larger roles, you know, I've been able to create and carve out my own flexibility in my workday. And I do think that it is a career path that if women stick with it and love it as much as I have and I did throughout my career, it's a really great career path for women. That said, there has been a lot of progress, certainly since 20 years ago when I started on Wall Street. I think that analyst programs across the different investment banks have done a really good job on the junior level, attracting, developing, and retaining talent in the analyst and associate programs. And the market and the industry has been really focused on, you know, those junior level talent coming out of undergraduate and MBA programs. What I think the industry still has to work on is the retention, development, promotion, you know, really developing equity at the more mid-level and senior level of women's careers. And I think we still as an industry lose a lot of women as they get to that VP level when they're in their early 30s. And maybe they have competing interests from an interest perspective that's outside of finance. And we tend to lose women at that critical juncture in their career. And so I think that over the next 10 years, what I'd like to see is more programs, more of an effort by the industry, really focused on retention and development of that mid-level career employee, particularly women, but of course, men as well. And I think that's going to be really critical to developing that senior level of talent for women in the industry.
Thank you very much for your time and being a guest today on the podcast. Our listeners will definitely enjoy the conversation and learning more about your career and your framework for analyzing risk in what is certainly a never say never environment for markets. So Erin, thanks so much. I'm glad we got a chance to do this.
Thanks for letting me be a part of this.
Thanks for listening to the Alpha Exchange. Before we go, I wanted to share with you an inspirational investment symposium I'm hosting on May 11th and 12th on behalf of Macro Minds, the foundation I launched in 2018 in order to raise money for nonprofits that focus on helping improve educational opportunities for children in the New York area. Our initiative is based on two primary ideas. First, educational shortfall for families is self-reinforcing. One statistic, the children of college-educated parents are 7 times as likely to go to college as are those whose parents did not finish high school. Working together, we can help push back against this cycle. The second idea behind Macro Minds is that the community of finance professionals is at its best when we engage together on the many difficult questions out there. Disinflation, crowded trades, monetary policy, cryptocurrencies, and the cost of hedging are just a few of these. Set against these uncertainties, what are the considerations most relevant to portfolio construction? What's the next big thing in finance and markets? On May 11th and 12th, these important topics will be explored. I couldn't be more excited to bring to you such accomplished market professionals who are offering their time and providing their insights. I hope that you will consider both attending and sponsoring the event. More on Macro Minds and the symposium can be found on our webpage, macrominds.org. On behalf of our partner charities, I sincerely thank you for your support.